welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, you're on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to Life Matters. Today, how to deal with those people who make your life miserable at work. You know who I mean. Complete bastards, and that's putting it politely. Americans have another word for them. Also, what it's like to fulfil that classic childhood dream of joining the circus. That's later. I want to begin today with a quote. We set ourselves this first goal. By 1990, no Australian child will be living in poverty. Bob Hawke said that, you may recall. He was launching the ALP's election promises in June 1987. 20 years on, we're little closer to meeting that goal. Almost 12% of Australian children live in poverty. Almost 10% live in a household where no parent is employed. Out of 24 OECD countries, we're 16th in infant mortality. These figures come from a report on child well-being by UNICEF, the UN's children's agency. There's more. We're only ranked 14th on child welfare and safety. And the Australian Bureau of Statistics says more than 4 out of 10 children under 15 have a long-term health condition. 12% of kids have asthma. 7% have a mental or behavioural problem. You get the picture? Australia's a wealthy country, but this prosperity clearly doesn't always lead to good outcomes in our children's well-being. I'm joined now by child health expert and former Australian of the Year, Professor Fiona Stanley. Fiona, welcome to Life Matters.
Richard, thank you very much. It's a bit sad going from this to being in the circus, but it's really important that you've actually having this debate today.
Well, yeah, that, what I want to get, all this cash, all this prosperity, and yet the kids are not all right.
Well, I hate to say that, you know, I told you so. I was criticised roundly by many people in the media during the 2003 Australian of the Year because I didn't have anything good to say about Australia, that I was being gloomy. But when you're faced with the sort of statistics that we were putting out even then and now predicting that they would get worse unless we understood the pathways into these problems rather than just focusing on the ends of the pathways, then we tried to put the information across in as positive a light as possible, that this was a wake-up call, that preventive strategies needed to be put in place. The exciting thing, I think, about the UNICEF report, where we actually do not fare very well on two counts, one that you've outlined, that we actually perform quite badly in comparison with other OECD countries and some key indicators, but also that we have data gaps so that we couldn't actually be assessed in the overall score. But it's interesting that the level of GDP does not predict good child outcomes.
It's counterintuitive almost, isn't it?
It is counterintuitive. It's not what you have, how much you have in terms of prosperity, it's what you do with it. It's so obvious really when you think about it. So how do countries like the Czech Republic perform far, far better than UK, USA, Australia, etc.? And that's what's exciting, because I just want to quote, if I can, very quickly, the comparisons are not demonstrate that given levels of child well-being are not inevitable but policy susceptible, and the wide differences can therefore be interpreted as a broad and realistic guide for the potential for improvement. And I think that's very exciting. In other words, we can turn this around if we start to look at what some of the other countries are doing that we're not doing. And I think that's very exciting, because we need a bit more data now to say, okay, well, we've got these variabilities. How do these countries differ in terms of the policies and practices that make a difference to kids?
Well, let's talk about the Czech Republic just briefly. I mean, it's a relatively small country. It's Eastern Europe. It has had some big problems and a major transition over the last 10 or 15 years. What are they doing better than us in terms of child well-being?
Well, I think specifically we don't actually know, and that's why we have to go the next step and get the information. But it may well be that they've been more protected from some of the incredibly negative social drivers of these poor outcomes compared with countries like UK and Australia. UK does particularly badly, as does the USA in many of these. They're worse on almost every indicator, and the UK by far worse on things like behavioural risks, alcohol and substance abuse. I mean, they're way down the bottom. The US isn't so bad on those things, but very bad on all of the other things like infant mortality and other outcomes. So we really have to look at why these things are different. And it may well be that the Czech Republic has not been exposed to such levels of consumerism, such inequalities in wealth, which drive so many marginalised families into inabilities to raise children properly. So it may well be that the Czech Republic is going to just have to catch up, which just sounds awful. But we need to look at what they're doing, what Norway's doing. Who's at the top of this.
And Norway's a very prosperous country.
It is. And basically, the non-English-speaking European countries, particularly Scandinavia and Holland, are at the top of this panel. And we know that they have valued parenthood so much more, and they've put huge investments into support for children's services for many, many years. So parenthood is just something that's valued by those societies much more than it is in English-speaking countries,
and
interestingly.
Those countries, the I suppose Scandinavian countries and Holland as well, I think, do very well in terms of education.
That's
not covered
in this. That's right. And you know that even though the data aren't in here for early childhood education because they said they didn't have the information, when we look at the other OECD reports that Barry McGaugh and others have put out, we know that Australia invests much less in early childhood education than other OECD countries. So that's one way we can actually invest more, which will make a difference. But I do think we need to look at, particularly looking at the ABS report on these health outcomes, we need to look at ways in which we can prevent these problems rather than saying, you know, we'll start investing when the problems have occurred. And that's the real message from the ABS report.
Just while we're on, I know there's not a lot of information in the OECD report, yeah, the UNICEF report on us, but where did we go particularly well and where did we go not so well?
Well, I think we went quite well in how kids viewed Australia. Kids actually felt quite good about being in Australia. The other thing was we did well in education, later education. So we performed very well there. But otherwise, we were in the middle of the pack or at the lower end of the pack in almost every other indicator.
What about New Zealand? Because New Zealand didn't do very well.
Some of the areas in which New Zealand had data and we didn't, I thought, I wonder if we're like them. Of course, having 15% Māori and Islander who are doing very poorly will drag New Zealand's overall assessments down, whereas 5% of Aboriginal kids will not make as much an impact on Australia's thing. But if you actually looked at Aboriginal children, of course, they would come up very badly and are always ones where we need to take a very strong view about what we're going to do about that inequality in our country.
It's interesting, the New Zealand thing, because they've put a big investment into early childhood, and they're often held up here as perhaps something that we could go more towards their model.
Emulate them more. I think the other thing, Richard, is we've got to... This is a sustainable investment. You can't say, well, we'll start this investment now in 2007 and next year things will improve.
Mm.
You've got to realise that this is sometimes an intergenerational investment. And what we've got to really push is saying not investing in this is going to be so costly. Don't expect immediate results.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Professor Fiona Stanley, Director of the Telethon Institute for Child Health Research and UNICEF Australia Ambassador for Early Childhood Development. It's interesting, talking about investment, Tony Blair has poured a lot of money into this area too, and yet the UK has come second to bottom.
But that's what I mean. It's going to take... So Sure Start was, a very innovative program, but it's going to take a while. Their own evaluation of Sure Start, which occurred only 2 or 3 years after the investment, was just too soon. There were some things that indicated that services were more acceptable to, for example, high-risk teenage mothers and so on. But on the whole, many of the indicators hadn't improved at all. I think there's a major issue here that we face, which is actually one that we need to consider very carefully, and that is that almost every single public policy that I can think of, except things that are legislated for, like fluoridation or hopefully mandatory fortification of flour with folate, had to get that one in, do not actually help the most disadvantaged and those at highest risk. So if you look at anything like prevention of cot deaths, tobacco and alcohol programs, services for a whole range of families, they are not either not acceptable or not taken up or not responded to by the most disadvantaged and the highest risk. We've got to do it differently, Richard. We've got to look at how these people really would respond to health promotion and other programs.
It's not all doom and gloom, is it? If you look at the Australian Bureau of Statistics' latest report, Health of Children in Australia, a snapshot...
Yeah.
Some things are improving, aren't they?
Oh, yes, and I think that that's what's exciting for me in this was the physical activity stuff, that in fact there were more children now exercising than there were in 2001, and that's fantastic. And I think those lifestyle risk factors are very good. Immunisation's pretty good, and it needs to be better at 6 years, but it's very good at 2 years of age. There might be pockets of kids who aren't vaccinated so well.
And we've also had significant gains in infant and child mortality.
Yes, and that's very good. And I think that includes Aboriginal children, although they didn't specifically analyse this by race. Yeah, we know that these rates for Aboriginal children are doing better. We've still got a long way to go. So yes, people might be interested to know that it's actually there are a lot of infant deaths in Australia, and it is a very vulnerable time for children to be born and get through that first year of life. Once they get through the first year of life, their death rates are actually very low until they hit early to mid-teenage when they go up with things like injury and mental health problems.
Yeah, well, mental health. We seem to have quite a high level of mental health problems in Australia among our children.
Well, I think we count them very well. We've got some very good surveys, both the ones done here in Western Australia and the one done by Mike Sawyer and his group nationally. And I think that when you do these surveys in other countries, like Canada's done them, the levels are very similar. But I do think there's going to be this variability. I'd love to see the Dutch data and the Norwegian data and see if they actually have lower rates of mental health problems. It would be very interesting.
And the report notes there's a strong association between mental health problems and social factors, including family makeup.
Absolutely. And this is where we get the marginalised families and... you know, this is where we're concerned about giving appropriate support for families who are disadvantaged. It might need to be different kinds of support than we give other families.
You kind of mentioned earlier that aggregated data for a nation is not always useful as it ignores the most disadvantaged groups. And in these results, clearly Indigenous children have poorer health.
That's right.
Does the extent of the poor health outcomes surprise you?
Not at all. I think that I would be surprised, given the risk factors that we know are occurring in our society, I would be surprised if we weren't seeing these degrees of problems. Of course, asthma is a different problem, and so is obesity and type 1 and 2 diabetes, which are going to continue to increase unless we, again, get to the causal pathways.
Actually, the type 1 diabetes thing is the mystery, isn't it? We know about type 2 to an extent, and obesity is related to it,
yes.
And that too is going up amongst our children. But type 1, that's gone up, and we don't really know why.
It might be similar to the kinds of things that are driving the asthma rates up. It's maybe something to do with the interaction of our immune system with the environment. And I think there's some very exciting research going on in both asthma and type 1 diabetes, internationally and locally, about that.
Now, you say we've got to do things differently. How? What do we do?
Well, I think when you start to look at some of the pathways into these problems, many of them do start in disadvantage. They start in environments that are not conducive. If you actually look at how... If we look at the Early Development Index, for example, which is a fabulous tool which we've adapted for Australian children, you can map that against and see that there's quite a lot of variability in our towns and cities in children who are developmentally healthy at the age of 5. And then you map the kinds of environments in which they're living, the services for them, and they map all the wrong way. So, in fact, we do have a job to actually target services more effectively in these children who are in poorer areas and in disadvantaged environments. I mean, children who are advantaged, their parents are actually going to get the best services for them. But with our disadvantaged children, parents find it very difficult to access. Even things like green space, even things like libraries, getting a speech pathology appointment, how quickly you can get to a GP, all of these things which are very important for children's health are actually harder for people who are living in poorer areas. So we have a job to do, and that's why we need to look at this UNICEF report and go a bit further and say, what are the policies that are so effective in some of these other European countries that we haven't got here in Australia. And I'd love to do that study. In fact, I'm going to meet up with people in OECD in April when I go to Europe and just see whether we can't do a study which actually goes further to help us work that out.
Just briefly, Fiona, it sounds like what you're calling for is a whole of government, across all levels of government, focus on the child.
We were calling for that in 2003. We're still calling for it now.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Professor Fiona Stanley, Director of the Telethon Institute for Child Health Research and Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Research Alliance for Children and Youth. She's also UNICEF Australia Ambassador for Early Childhood Development. And the two reports we were discussing were Health of Children in Australia, a snapshot which has been published by the ABS, and An Overview of Child Wellbeing in Rich Countries, which has been published by UNICEF. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Later, what happens when a girl says, I want to join the circus? Next, how to deal with that person at work who drives you crazy.
Home Sweet Home may be Melbourne, Victoria for Fiona Boys, but her album was recorded in Austin, Texas, and I'm sure she'll be there at the Blues Music Awards, where she's been the first Australian to be nominated for Contemporary Blues Album of the Year. Her latest CD, Lucky 13, is a corker, covers all kinds of blues styles, enthused by her great vocals and exhilarating guitar. Lots of great musicians on it. Hope you can join me right here on ABC Radio National for The Daily Planet this afternoon at 2:20 and tonight at 11:20.
There's always one, isn't there? That person at work who drives you up the wall, plays power games, undermines you. They can make your daily life a misery. It might be your boss, or it might be the person in the next workstation. Professor of Management Science at Stanford University, Robert Sutton, believes that we should have a zero-tolerance attitude to what the Americans call assholes, and he says there are ways of fighting back that don't involve poisoning the tea. Robert Sutton, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you've worked in academia for quite a few years. Have you worked with people you call assholes?
Yes, I have actually, in academia and also outside of academia. So I've been exposed to them in all sorts of places.
Do you remember the first time you encountered one?
Well, I remember lots of time. One example, this was a long time ago. This was when I was a new assistant professor, so about 20 years ago. And I had won the Outstanding Teaching Award in my department. And I hate to put down the French, so I don't want to damn all of them, but I had a French colleague who walked up to me and gave me a giant hug for public consumption, and she whispered sort of a nasty, sweet nothing into my ear about how essentially that winning the teaching award was a sign that if I was a great teacher, it meant that I couldn't do research.
Ooh.
And it was sort of quite a performance because it shows how many of the most sort of politically effective assholes operate, which is they look all nice and friendly, and then they stab you in the back.
Mm. It's a crude but all-encompassing term, isn't it? Can there be a precise definition?
I have a PhD in psychology, and I'll try to give you one, but at the same time, you never should trust academics too much.
Okay.
The definition that I use that I think captures a lot of the emotion for me is, first of all, I do it from the perspective of the victim. If you encounter somebody and they leave you feeling demeaned or de-energized, especially if they've got more power than you, that to me is a sign that they're an asshole. If they do it once or twice, to me that means they're a temporary asshole. And if they do it repeatedly, that to me means they're a certified asshole.
Right, so there's temporary assholes and certified. I'm just going to say asshole because I can't say asshole without feeling silly. So I guess...
I think you should say arsehole. In fact, I sometimes wonder for the UK and for Australia, if we should have had a different title. We translated it in other languages. Why not into English or Australian in your case?
Now, I guess many of us would qualify for the temporary version.
Right, yes.
Do you?
And
Have you done that?
Yes. Oh, yes. In fact, even worse than that or better than that, I actually tell stories on myself that when I've been overworked or tense, I've definitely raged at people at work and I've apologized later. In fact, I think the key ideas in the book is the notion that asshole poisoning is a contagious disease, or arsehole poisoning, as you might call it. It's something that you get from others and then you give to others. And this is very consistent with the fairly large body of research on what researchers call emotional contagion, which is that if you enter a group with a bunch of assholes, you're going to start acting like them and you're going to start treating people that way.
And what about typical behaviours, Robert? I know that in the book you've got a list I'm sure many of our listeners would recognise.
Well, to me, I sort of think of it as three general categories, although I have the usual list. The first one is simply sort of treating people like they're invisible, mm-hmm. which to me can be quite bad. The second one is finding either a subtle or not so subtle way to put people down or demean them, so either glaring at them or teasing them nastily. And then the last one is sort of like the backstabbing approach, where you seem like you're real friendly, but then you sort of just stab them in the back behind their back. And to me, those are the general general categories. Also, with a guy named Guy Kawasaki here, I've developed a test. So you can take a self-test on the online, which is called ARSE, A-R-S-E, so the correct spelling for you guys. We've had 11,000 people fill it out this week, so a lot of people are analyzing themselves here.
We'll get on to that a bit later. Now, what is the no-asshole rule?
The no-asshole rule to me is actually, it isn't just an individual rule that you might apply to yourself. Actually, in the case studies and the like that I've done, I've found a number of companies, largely in the States, because that's where I live and I know them, that actually apply no-jerk rules or no-asshole rules in their screening processes, and they don't let people get away with it.
So this is about who you hire.
Well, it isn't just about who you hire. It's about the way you train people, and then when people transgress, because all of us are bad occasionally, what happens? So to give you a quick example of a company I've been working with and hanging out with lately, there's a software firm in the United States called SuccessFactors. It's grown very quickly from 100 to 400 employees in the last year. And they have all new employees sign, they call it the rules of engagement.
Uh-huh.
And the last one is that I won't be an asshole. And the CEO, his name is Lars Dahlgaard, he has people sign this statement. And they take it seriously. And in fact, one of my favorite things is on the company blog right now, there's an example of an employee who was thanked by his manager when he told his manager he was a jerk. So the blog posting is, I called my manager a jerk and he thanked me. And that's very consistent with the norms in that company. They select people who are nice people. They have them sign the statement. And when you make a mistake, including if you're the CEO, Lars has sent out company-wide apologies for his behavior. It's something you have to come clean about.
Well, I mean, obviously careful hiring is key, and you need to kind of screen out potential problems. But apart from checking their references, how do you do that?
Well, from my perspective, I mean, you see how they behave in interviews, of course, and the other thing is to check their references. But I actually think that for many behaviors, and there's a lot of actually research on industrial psychology to support this, that personality is maybe worth 8 or 10% of it. But if you take a perfectly reasonable person and you put them in a sort of jerk-infested workplace with a bunch of assholes, then even a perfectly reasonable person is going to start acting like that. So while screening is part of it, that isn't enough. But having said that, I mean, a great example is one company I've interviewed a lot is people from Southwest Airlines, which is the most financially successful U.S. airline now. And there's a great story that Herb Kelleher, who's the chairman and former CEO, tells, which is that they once had a pilot candidate who was nasty to the receptionist.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a good sign when people are nasty to lower status people. So this notion of sort of being a kiss-up, kick-down sort of person,
yeah.
That's a sign that they're likely failing the test.
Now, Robert, what about, I mean, it's all very well to try and stop people getting in, but I mean, in any large organization, they're going to be there. What do you do when you encounter them, and what can you do to try and get rid of them once they're in the organization?
Well, a good example, actually, both SuccessFactors and Southwest actually warn people and have fired people for the behavior. But my favorite example is the case of Ethan. Ethan actually still is a salesperson, a very successful salesperson at a Silicon Valley company. And actually in the book we calculate the total cost, but he's an asshole, his total cost for 1 year. And I had a detailed interview with a senior executive about this person and saw the numbers. And so this is somebody who kept going through assistance. He kept having like charges brought up against him. He was constantly nagging the staff to do very detailed work. And they calculated that the extra cost that he incurred for 1 year, so the cost of one asshole for 1 year, was $160,000 U.S. And then they deducted about $100,000 from his bonus and told him why. So to me, that's a pretty effective message. And all signs are that Ethan has straightened up quite a bit.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Robert Sutton, who's Professor of Management Science at Stanford University and author of The No Asshole Rule, Building a Civilized Workplace and Surviving One That Isn't. Well, you can actually cost this out then. You can measure it in dollar terms.
Well, in this case, in this particular company, I've got this chart that's the total cost of assholes that has some of the different things you might look for, like the number of assistants they go through, the cost of them forcing out other people to leave. And to me, that's a guideline for a particular organization. But in this organization I'm talking about, what happened was that Ethan's bosses and the human resource managers who were so abused by him, they got upset enough at him that they devoted an enormous amount of time to documenting how much he was costing.
Right.
And even they were surprised by how much it cost. And I think you have to have knowledge about what's going on in the organization. And as I said to the manager or the executive I talked to about this, I said, so did you calculate the amount of time it took to calculate this? And he said no, and it took us a couple of days. So that was another cost, actually.
Now, he sounds like, well, he's clearly was a had value to them. He was an outstanding individual. And I've met people in fields as diverse as science and journalism,
right,
and dare I say it, broadcasting, who are complete bastards, but
yeah,
they're so good that they're not
right
going anywhere.
Well, it sounds to me like in Australia that you're applying the same standards for better, worse that we do in the United States, which is that if you're really a big winner in sports, or you're bringing a lot of money, you can get away with being a really big asshole. And exhibit number one, in fact, I feature him in the chapter on the virtues of assholes, is our own Steve Jobs, the leader of Apple and Pixar and other places.
Yeah.
And so I'm in Silicon Valley, and I teach in the Stanford Engineering School, and I run into a lot of people who have a lot of jobs experience.
Yeah.
And just I was at a meeting just about 2 weeks ago, and it's funny, if you say the word asshole in Silicon Valley, you don't have to mention his name. Somebody comes up and tells you a Steve Jobs story. It's just amazing. And there's a certain pride that if you haven't been yelled at him, which I haven't been, you're like nobody.
Hey, look out. If he hears this, you're gone.
No, actually, it's very well documented. I mean, I don't think he'll sue me, actually. There's too much evidence against him. I went through the legal screen and everything. So anyway, so I was talking to this person afterwards. As soon as I said that I was writing a book or had written a book on assholes, he came up to me and he said, I've been to many, many meetings with Steve Jobs. And he said, I've seen him belittle people. I've seen him make people cry. But the problem with Steve Jobs, and this is the problem, is that he was almost never wrong. One of the problems with assholes is sort of interesting. On one hand, you actually can make a case. In fact, I make an empirical case that anytime you're in a profession where intimidating people or fear, I mean, sports are a great example, that, you know, rugby being an asshole is really quite effective, that it might be to your benefit. And there's also times if you're in an organization that has sort of an I win, you lose sort of environment, then it might also work. So there are times when it might be effective. But the problem that I like to say is, well, first of all, there's plenty of people who are successful without getting ahead. But if you're a winner and you're an asshole, you're still an asshole in my book. But not everybody agrees with me.
It's interesting. You mentioned sport, and I wanted to ask you about it, Robert, because in mm-hmm. sport, if you're a match winner, you're paid a lot of money, you're part of the marketing for the team, you are going to get quite a lot of slack.
Right.
Though I just thought I'd tell you this about something that's happened here. One of the most successful Australian football franchises in Australia, the Sydney Swans, has what they call a no dickheads policy.
Now, good for them.
Now, part of that, I think refers to issues like responsibility around alcohol and drugs, but it also incorporates what you're talking about.
Oh, that's bad. Well, actually, that's interesting to have a no dickheads rule, because on the internet, like, I've done a lot of stuff on internet sort of social control for, like, the way that people who play online gaming keep people in line, and the rule is don't be a dick. So it's the same rule, and I think it's pretty similar. When I think of the notion of assholes, to me, it's something that, this is why I like to say assholes are us. We're all capable of becoming it in the wrong situation. And two of the worst situations are, number one, when you go into a situation where everybody's acting like that. And I would even argue this is the opposite of your no dickhead policy. If you're in an environment where everybody's nasty and putting each other down and doing backstabbing, to survive, you probably have no choice but to act that same way or to get out, which is my main advice. So that's the first part. And the other part, which is very well documented and is a problem for stars of all kinds, is that when you take ordinary people and put them in positions of power, there's a lot of evidence that they become more focused on greedily satisfying their own needs and ignoring the needs and feelings of others. So the notion that power turns people into jerks is actually quite well documented by a lot of research.
Well, Len, I'd like to start to wrap things up on your ideas for suppressing what you call the inner jerk. What are the signs that your inner jerk is rearing its ugly head?
well, to me, some of the signs are if you start thinking you're smarter than everybody else. Whenever you're in a situation and other people are successful, you really think you're the person who is responsible for their success. If you walk into a room and it suddenly becomes silent and people stop having fun when you show up, to me those are signs that you're sort of feared and being seen as a jerk, both the way that you see other people and the way that other people respond to you. And where I really think is, in many cases, the root of this is if you start seeing yourself as superior to everybody else or impatient with them, their incompetence and slowness, to me that's very often the beginning of it.
Well, I know you've developed the self-test, but is it true that MIT has developed a jerkometer?
A jerkometer, yes. This researcher, it's a voice breath analyzer, and if you attach it to your phone, and they just have it in prototype form, that it indicates whether you're being a jerk by the tension in your voice. So yes, I've got it described in the book, and you can go to the MIT. Media Lab website and find a whole academic article about the jerkometer and why it's so effective.
Well, Professor Robert Sutton, this has been an extremely helpful interview. And at the urging of my colleagues, I'm off to do the inner jerk self-test right
Thank
now.
You very much.
Thank you very much for being on Life Matters today.
Thank you.
Robert Sutton's book is called The No Asshole Rule, Building a Civilized Workplace and Surviving One That Isn't. It's published by Sphere. And we will link to both Robert's website, where you can do the self-test, and also perhaps to the MIT website as well. You need to go to our website for both of these, and that, I'll remind you, is abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm off to join the circus. Plenty of parents would be aghast if their child said that, but most of the parents whose children have joined the Flying Fruit Fly Circus based in Albury-Wodonga are right behind their kids. Family commitments are one of the cornerstones of this unique circus training and performing company and its associated school. The Flying Fruit Flies are in the middle of a national tour of a show called Circus Girl. So we're going to find out what the life of a circus girl is like. Alice Muntz is 14 and performing in Circus Girl. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
Carol Miller's a maths and science teacher with the school that the performers attend. She's on tour with the girls as well. Hello, Carol.
Good morning.
And Annette Walton is a former member of the Fruit Flies board. She's also the mother of Indigo, who, like Alice, is 14 but hasn't been able to perform for a couple of years because of a fairly serious injury. Welcome, Annette.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty well. Alice, I want to begin with you. You and your family have quite a history with the fruit flies. How old were you when you joined?
I was 7. I started in year 3.
Right, okay. And your older sister, Ellie, was already at the circus when you started, but she's since left, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has. She started a year earlier than me.
She got an injury?
Yeah, she did. She was born with a back injury, and then once we became aware of it, she stopped some things, and then she found that circus wasn't the right thing for her, so that's why she left.
Was that a big disappointment for her, though?
No, not really, because she continued with drama, and the circus opened a lot of doors for her and showed her how to perform, a lot of stuff like that.
Right, okay. And you've got a younger sister as well, Kate.
Yes, I do.
And she's also in the circus?
Yeah.
And she's, how old is she?
She's 11.
And you two have a double act, is that right?
Yeah, we're working on one. It's called Cradle, where I hang by my knees and I hold onto her hands or I swing her around and we hit pretty shapes and, yeah.
I've actually seen some photos of you in action and you do seem to spend a lot of time upside down.
Yeah.
What's the best thing about being in the Fruit Flies?
Well, we get to perform and tour in some amazing theatres and great, meet tons of new people and, like, and do radio shows.
Right.
Yeah.
And the showing off itself of the actual skills.
Yeah, professional show off, I call it.
Now, for you, it's not far from home. Your family already lived in the area.
Yeah.
But some of the other students, they come a long way, don't they?
Yeah, some kids come from Sydney and Melbourne and or Benalla and stuff like that, and they come down and board with another family from the circus, or they board with families just in Albury.
Anyone from WA or the Territory?
Yeah, we do. We have two new people. We have one from Perth. She's my age. And then another boy from Broome, I think it is. Yeah.
Right. Now, this current show you're in, the one that's touring, I don't think your younger sister is in this, is Circus Girl. It opens in Sydney tomorrow night. What's the basic story of the show?
Well, it's about girls growing up in the circus, really. It's about what they go through just as teenage girls or growing up and everything, and then how we deal with getting into shows and some of our friends don't, going on tour, having a great time doing the shows and then coming back and meeting everyone, and how the people that didn't get in the show, how they react to that.
Well, yeah, does that competition sort of strain friendships?
In the show, that's an issue.
Yeah. I imagine in real life it's an issue too.
Yeah. Oh, well, for some people, but for me, if my friend gets in a show that I really wanted to get in but I didn't, I just feel that, well, I didn't have the right skills for that show, and I'll just work on my skills and get ready for the next one that comes along.
Annette Walton, I want to bring you in. Not being chosen for one show is one sort of setback, and Alice is very sanguine about it. I admire that. But injury is another matter altogether. Tell us what happened to your daughter, Indigo.
She was just doing a warm-up exercise and was overstretched.
Right.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound too debilitating.
No, but it badly injured her hip, her pelvis and her spine.
Right. Okay. So has she been out of the circus?
Yeah. For the last 2 years, she's been on her injury, recovering and doing rehab and all of those sort of things. And she'll have an operation in a few weeks and then she'll be back to it.
She'll be going back to the circus?
Absolutely. That's what she wants to do.
Right. So she was... That sounds very determined.
The circus is amazing. The kids are amazing. The teachers are amazing. The lifestyle's amazing. And she wants to finish that journey. So as parents, we can only support her in that.
Now, you said her hip was, dislocated, pulled out?
The muscles were torn and stretched and ripped.
So she must have been in quite a lot of pain.
Yeah, she still is. That's what the operation is about. The first one is to remove the pain.
Right, okay. And it's more than 2 years now, or 2 years, I understand.
2 years. The original injury happened in the end of January, early February.
Okay, so 2 years. Has she already had a go at a comeback, or is this the first go at a comeback?
She went back for a couple of days at the start of last year, but it wasn't time as yet. So she's been pursuing other interests in the performing arts sort of while she's been getting everything back together.
What's her reality now, though? Can she perform? Can she perform at all, or can she perform but not at the same level, or what?
No, she can't do most of what she used to do as yet, but she wants to rebuild her body to get back to that level, and I admire her determination for that. She has difficulty walking sometimes and is in pain, but as I said, it's an amazing place. And Alice said before with Ellie, they teach you so many other skills as well around the performing arts, and confidence. And there's a whole heap of great things going on that Indigo wants to be back there. Maybe her body will be able to do what it once could. Maybe it won't.
Because I would imagine she's older now.
She's 14 as well.
She's going to be bigger than she was.
Yep.
She'll have to go back and start with kids younger and smaller.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's going to be really hard and difficult. Yeah, especially in a place like the circus where, you know, you work so hard from when you're young to get to a certain age and a certain level. Yeah, she'll have to go back and start with the new kids who'll probably have more skills than her when she gets back into it.
Were you angry about this at all, Annette?
Angry? No, not angry.
Well, I mean, because the injury... when you first talked about it, it didn't sound very serious, but it clearly was quite severe and she's still in pain.
Mm.
You didn't think of suing or protesting or anything like that?
No, I don't think... we didn't protest as such. We sat down and worked through some different programs with the circus in regard to how we can make sure that doesn't happen again.
How did it happen exactly?
She just got overstretched by a couple of trainers.
Right.
Yeah.
So hang on. Overstretch, because when you first of all said she was overstretched, but I mean, I could overstretch myself. In fact, it'd be very easy for me to overstretch myself, seeing as I'm in such terrible condition. But I'm sure she was.
Oh my!
She was in fantastic condition. Mm. And how did she get overstretched by a couple of trainers? I nearly said strainers. There is that a?
No, she was just in the middle splits and against a wall, and her knees were pulled backwards to give her an extra stretch. But she's a hyperflexible person, so she was already fully stretched, and it was a traditional Chinese and Russian stretch that was done to her. But because she was a young girl who was very flexible, it didn't go necessarily the right way, you know. Were we angry? Well, we were sad for her that she'd worked so hard and because she came from somewhere else to go to the circus. Sad also because she lost contact with her friends and she needs to rebuild those relationships again. Angry, it wasn't anyone's fault. It was just the way it happened, and people were only doing what they were done to them when they were being trained as youngsters. So, you know, and everyone did it with the best of intention. There's no point jumping up and down and screaming at people.
All the same, you must have had some conflicting feelings about this.
Because
you're her mum. You'd want to wrap her in cotton wool, wouldn't you? I mean,
absolutely. And do I want to, you know, I'm probably hesitant myself personally about her going back to the school. But, that's the journey she wants to take. And it is amazing. Like Alice said, they go on tour. They meet amazing people, the teachers, the care that they've given her. Carol's actually Indy's teacher. She's fantastic. The way the circus is, the trainers, you know, there's some hard things. But there isn't a school or an institution like it in the country doing the same thing. It's great.
On Life Matters today, we're talking about Circus Girl, which is a show that the Flying Fruit Fly Circus is putting on. We're talking about what it's like to be a circus girl. We have one here with us in the studio, Alice Munce, and we've also just been hearing from Annette Walton, whose daughter, Indigo, sustained an injury and hasn't been able to perform and hopes to make a comeback. And we also have with us Carol Miller, who's a teacher who travels around with them as they tour and is very much part of the circus. Carol, does the school have any, I suppose, formal means of working with girls who have setbacks like Indigo went through?
We do have a formal program, not just for people injured, but it's part of our school curriculum for all the students. It's based on the You Can Do It program, which was developed by Dr. Michael Barnard. And it's based around the five foundations of confidence, organisation, getting along, persistence and resilience. So the students spend time each week, doing those formally, looking at ways that you can help develop some of those things, the habits of mind that they'll need to be able to develop themselves. And then we try and live by that, if you like, at our school in our everyday program.
So an injury like Indigo's, that's an extreme example.
It is.
But there are, I suppose, numerous challenges for kids doing these things. Every day they have to kind of surmount obstacles.
That's right. I mean, it's true for all young people, but even more so in the performing arts, where they're competing against each other, if you like. At the same time, they're the people that they're closest to, so it does raise some issues for them.
And it occurs to me that the highly technical skills, and I've seen the photos of Alice doing some things that I wouldn't be able to do if I had essentially about a century of training. They take a lot of practice and a lot of doing, and although they look extraordinary when you go and see them, it must be quite dull doing it over and over and trying.
Obviously, that in our persistence, when we're talking about persistence, that's exactly what we say. You can't get really good at something without training, and sometimes the training's boring. And I tell the kids the same with the schoolwork. So what we are doing now may not seem the most exciting thing in the world, but it's leading to somewhere.
What about rejection? How does that come into it? Because there's not just the rejection issue of not making a particular show. There's also the issue of perhaps wanting this to be your life and at some point having to recognise that that's not going to happen.
Yes, that's true. And I guess the things we try to instil in the kids is to look at why things didn't happen for them, perhaps draw out any positives they can, and then to set some goals that might send them in a slightly different direction, but still, you know, continue their passion.
Mm. Well, if you're building resilience all the time, it's...
That's right, yes.
How do they compare? I mean, in your sixth year as a teacher with the school...
This will be my sixth year, yes.
How does the school population compare to the mainstream school sector?
I think the biggest thing is, well, it's a small school. We only have 60 students, but it's the family feel. Kids often say the circus is like a family, and it's not just the kids that have to make a commitment to the circus, really. It's their parents and, in fact, their whole families that make a commitment. And they're a very caring bunch. They do look after each other. It makes touring with them much easier than a normal school excursion because it does have that family feel.
So it's more marked than the normal community feeling you might get at a well-run ordinary school.
I think so, because that circus element, the kids have to trust each other. They have to be able to work with each other doing their circus tricks. So it's a much stronger feeling than I've found in other schools.
Are they more show-offy?
Occasionally.
Alice is smiling and keeping very quiet at the moment.
No, occasionally, but most of the time, no. You know, it continues to amaze me that the kids, they're very proud of what they do, but they don't see themselves above, you know, anyone else.
No. Mm. What about, I suppose, you've already mentioned families, and I suppose that'd be another area of difference, because in a normal school, you're going to have issues with some kids and their families. The family life may not be that productive to schoolwork and to being motivated, whereas any kid who's there, the family's got to be 100% behind them or it's not going to work at all.
That's true. I mean, there are some issues that come from families, but on the whole, we find that our families are really supportive, so we don't have that situation in most mainstream schools where you have really dysfunctional families. Because they couldn't be like, the kids couldn't have no backing from home to be where they are.
No, quite. What are the career paths out of the school? Because there must be a very limited number of roles for circus performers in Australia.
Yes, it actually only a small percentage probably go on to performing arts. A larger percentage than in most schools, of course. But a lot of our kids leave school and become all sorts of things, you know, accountants and shop assistants and vets, whatever. But, of course, we do have the core who do want to stay in the performing arts, and some stay with circus and some branch out slightly into other areas of performing arts.
I suppose a number of the kids that you have there they love it, they're right into it, but they know that ultimately they want to go off and be a vet or something
sure.
like that.
Sure, some kids are truly there and we admit they admit this and we're happy to accept this, that they're there for the good experience for a few years.
I'll come back to Alison in a moment to find out what she wants to be when she grows up, but just before I do, Annette Walton, if I come back to you, you've been on the board and look, despite what Indigo's gone through, you're clearly extremely supportive of the circus.
Yep.
If you could change anything about it, what would you change?
I think the only thing that I would change, which isn't actually about the fruit flies, it's probably about circus in Australia, and people are working on it. Physical circus is so new. It's only, you know, 25, 30 years old in Australia. And I think it would be about having, you know, national standards for trainers and a greater understanding of, you know, what can go wrong and some supports in there that can allow those things to happen, which I suppose comes, you know, with greater funding and all of those related issues. I think that in Indy's case, you know, the physio jokingly says, or seriously says, this was the worst case scenario for what that sort of injury, and it was. And it didn't happen because people were negligent or because people were stupid. All that happened was because people the industry as such doesn't have those skills as yet. So I suppose my dream for circus would be increased funding so that they can look at, and not just the fruit flies, all the circuses that are happening, that there is greater opportunity to increase the level of education around the people who are trainers and around the infrastructure itself. And that's not a reflection on the fruit flies. That's a general comment because I think that as a new style of performing arts grows, things happen and people can't perceive what's going to happen. And following traditions from other countries, which are quite different to Australia, is great, but we need to market as ours. And the fruit flies are doing that. They're working really hard on making that happen. And that's a great thing, I think.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Annette.
No worries.
Alice, I just have to finish with you. You're clearly going to be a vet when you grow up. That's right, isn't it?
No, I'm definitely going to be a circus performer. We'll try to be anyway.
Have you got a plan B?
Well, I would like to do photography.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
That would be great fun, I think.
But you're seeing that as a hobby at the moment, aren't you?
Well, yeah. Well, I'm only in year 9, so I don't really...
No need for a plan B yet.
Yeah.
Okay. And are there any other potential fruit flies at home? At your place?
Well, I do have a little brother. He's 9, and he is doing the circus arts program on Saturday morning. He's not sure if he wants to be in the circus yet. He just says to me that he wants to learn how to do flips. So, yeah.
Okay, so maybe, possibly, we'll have to see. Thank you very much, all of you, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pleasure, thank you.
We've had Alice Munts, who's currently performing in Circus Girl with the Flying Fruit Fly Circus. The show's just been to the New South Wales Central Coast. It is at the Parade Theatre in Kensington this week. It opens tomorrow. And thanks also to teacher Carol Miller, who is with the Fruit Flies, and parent Annette Walton, whom we heard from before. Coming up next, your letters, following on our discussion last Thursday for Australians on the Move.
I'm Jeff McMullen. Join me on ABC TV for Difference of Opinion, a show that debates the new ideas and issues that matter to Australians. On our next program, What to Do About Australia's Water Crisis, our panel of experts will answer the hard questions with practical ideas and solutions that work. Waterproofing Australia on Difference of Opinion, 9:30 tonight on ABC TV.
Just time for a few letters in reaction to Australians on the Move. This one's from Stephen. He said, after I lost my job and our small farm was failing, we moved to South Australia from New South Wales. For me, this was moving from a stressful job with a high-pressure employer to one with an easier pace and better lifestyle. For the family as a whole, we have more time with each other and are mentally better for it. It has put into perspective for me the importance of my partner to me and my well-being versus job and financial aspirations. This one's from Lorna. Having been to more than 9 schools in 5 different countries, not with the ADF, my parents always concentrated on the positives of a move, new friends, new things to explore, and the opportunities that went with a move. They did not concentrate on the possible hiccups that may happen. I believe parents today concentrate too much on the possible negative impacts of change. And time for one more from Theo. Your expert commentator said that all children have problems with moving. My experience was of moving between year 4 and 5 from one part of Perth to another and losing my best friend who moved to New Zealand at the same time. That was hard personally, but not educationally. I then moved from Perth to Adelaide between year 11 and year 12, and that was fine on both scores. New friends and no scholastic dramas either. Please, let's not have blanket statements. We'll have more of your letters and calls on Wednesday. And now to someone else with robust opinions always, and that's Ramona, to find out what's coming up on the book show.
Well, a big show on the book show today, Richard. We're looking at the legal risks for publishers, for publishing a book, for authors as well. And also on another legal story, rescuing science from politics, regulation and the distortion of scientific research. Many of the leading names in law and science from across America have contributed to this book about political manipulation of scientific research, and we'll do that too, and more.
Join Ramona after the news, which is coming up in a tick, for that. Now, tomorrow on Life Matters, we hear from one of Australia's top modelling agents on what she thinks about the call to ban waif-thin models from the catwalk. Don't forget our evening edition tonight. See you then.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.